Good afternoon, listeners. We are the Dogs Program, the Australian Council for Defence of Government Schools, and we're here to promote and to defend public education. And as you can imagine, that's not private education. It's not Catholic education, also called independent schools. And we're very interested always in the facts and figures. And we're very fortunate that Trevor Cobalt up there in Canberra with the Save Our Schools has been at work again. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. New NAPLAN results demand more immediate funding increases for public schools. The latest NAPLAN results reveal the enormity of the challenges facing Australia's school system. They show vast achievement gaps between rich and poor, a huge proportion of equity group cohorts not achieving national proficiency standards, and a very large proportion in need of additional support in their learning. Unfortunately, the education equity targets and new funding agreements between the Commonwealth and state and territory governments provide little prospect that the gaps can be reduced. Urgent action is needed to ensure that public schools are fully funded in the near future. Year 9 students of parents with a bachelor's degree or higher achieved at much higher average scores in reading, writing and numeracy than students of parents who only completed Year 11. The gaps were 98 points for reading, 107 points for writing, and 111 points for numeracy. They represent a learning gap of 4 to 5 years because Year 9 students of parents with only a Year 11 education achieved average literacy and numeracy scores below that of Year 5 students of highly educated parents. Note, the achievement gap is a difference between the mean score between different student cohorts. For example, the mean reading score of students whose parents have a bachelor's degree is 96.5 points higher than on the NAPLAN scale than that of students whose parents who have a Year 11 education. In addition, Year 9 students of parents in the highest occupational group 1, elected officials, senior executives, managers, management in large business organisations, government administration and defence, and qualified professionals, scored 63 to 71 points more than students of parents in the lowest occupation group. Occupation Group 4, machine operators, sales office service, hospitality staff, assistants, labourers and related workers. This represents a learning gap of nearly 4 years. Students from the highest occupation group achieved 83 to 96 points more than those of parents not in paid work, and which represent over 4 years of learning. The gap between Indigenous students and those of highly educated parents remained very large. 98 points for reading, 111 points for writing, and 116 points for numeracy. These gaps represent over 4 years of learning for reading and nearly 5 years for writing and numeracy. The equivalent gap for remote area students is about 4 years, while that for very remote area students is nearly 6 years. The NAPLAN results also reveal that very large proportions of disadvantaged students are not achieving national proficiency standards in reading, writing and numeracy. For example, over half to two-thirds of disadvantaged Year 9 students do not achieve the standards as shown by the following percentages. 64 to 65% of students whose parents have a Year 11 education, 49 to 51% of students whose parents are in the lowest paid occupation group, 58 to 59% of students whose parents are not in paid work, 65 to 67% of Indigenous students, 56 to 60% of remote area students, and 77 to 80% of very remote area students. By contrast, only 16 to 23% of students of highly educated parents and 18 to 24% of parents in the highest occupation group did not achieve the standards. The proportion of disadvantaged students not achieving the standards is about 3 times that of more advantaged students. There was little change in the proportion of disadvantaged students not achieving the proficiency standards since 2023. The only exception is a small increase in the proportion of Indigenous students achieving the reading and writing standards. Many disadvantaged students are not achieving at the basic minimum standards and are only achieving at the lowest proficiency level. For example, the following percentages of Year 9 students need additional learning support in reading, writing and numeracy. 29 to 31% of students whose parents have a Year 11 education, 17 to 19% of students whose parents are in the lowest paid occupation group, 25 to 27% of students whose parents are not in paid work, 31 to 35% of Indigenous students, 27 to 32% of remote area students, 54 to 59% of very remote area students. By contrast, only 3 to 5% of students of highly educated parents and 4 to 5% of parents in the highest occupation group need additional learning support. These are massive differences between advantaged and disadvantaged students. The proportion of disadvantaged students needing additional support is generally 4 to 7 times that of advantaged students, and even more in the case of students in very remote areas. The proportions of disadvantaged Year 9 students in need of additional support are similar to those in 2023. There was a small reduction in the proportion of Indigenous students needing additional support in reading and writing. The large majority of disadvantaged students attend public schools. A study by Save Our Schools shows that the large majority of students from low socio-educational advantage, SEA, families attend public schools. In 2023, 81% of all low SEA students attended public schools, and 91% of all schools with over 50% of their students in the lowest SEA quartile were public schools. Nearly one third of all students in public schools are from low SEA families. Other data drawn from the My Schools dataset show that public schools enrol 82% of Indigenous students, 79% of remote area students, and 87% of very remote area students. The Heads of Agreement of the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement specifies targets to increase equity in school outcomes by 2030. However, the agreement lacks a clear definition of equity. This means that the targets are too weak to make Australian school education fairer. For example, there is no requirement to reduce the proportion of disadvantaged students in the NAPLAN level needing additional support. This is an incredible oversight, and it could even worsen inequity. Despite this heavy concentration of disadvantaged students in public schools, government funding increases adjusted for inflation have strongly favoured Catholic and independent schools since 2009. Between 2009 and 2023, government funding, Commonwealth and state, for Catholic schools increased by $3,101 per student and by $2,708 in independent schools, compared to $2,091 for public schools. In percentage terms, the 34.8% increase for Catholic schools was double the 17.5% increase for public schools, while funding for independent schools increased by 21.2%. Private schools have also received increased income from fees and other sources, which provide them with a significant resource advantage over public schools. Public schools have long been underfunded for the learning challenges they face. In 2024, they were only funded at an average of 88% of their schooling resource standard, SRS, across Australia. By contrast, private schools were overfunded on average at 104% of their SRS. The Prime Minister and his Education Minister promised that the Better and Fairer Schools Agreement will ensure that public schools are fully funded by 2034. This has already proved to be false. New funding agreements with the New South Wales, Queensland, South Australian, Western Australian and Tasmanian governments reveal that public schools will not be funded at 100% of their SRS by 2034, despite a significant planned boost in funding over the decade. Public schools in these states, and also likely in Victoria when its agreement is finally published, will be underfunded because the states can continue to use non-SRS expenditures as part of their SRS funding share. They can claim expenditure on school transport up to 1.8% of their SRS, 1.5% for WA and Tasmania share, and all expenditure on regulatory authorities, such as curriculum and standards related to public schools. These expenditures are specifically excluded from how the SRS is measured. As a result, public schools will continue to receive less funding than they should. Continuing underfunding of public schools for another decade means there is little prospect of removing, indeed even reducing, the large achievement gap between rich and poor and increasing the proportion of disadvantaged students achieving the National Literacy and Numeracy Proficiency Standards. This is a disaster for the future learning and life prospects of disadvantaged students. It also has broader consequences for individuals' health and social outcomes. Reducing the achievement gaps between rich and poor students is critical to improving workforce skills and productivity. In fact, the achievement gaps are a measure of the potential for productivity improvements and higher living standards. Fully funding public schools is fundamental to increasing national productivity. Public schools face a funding crisis. Governments have to be forced to fully support public education. It demands an organised response from public school and community organisations. Teacher, parent, principal and community groups must collectively organise and campaign at the school, district, state and national levels to demand a better deal for public schools. A better deal should include: the Better and Fairer School Funding Heads of Agreement should be revised to include a target to halve the proportion of disadvantaged students needing additional support by 2029. The Commonwealth should accelerate the increase in its funding share of the SRS public schools to achieve 25% by 2029. The bilateral funding agreements should be revised so that state and territory governments remove the 4% rort by 2029, immediately remove all allowances for state and territory governments to include non-SRS expenditures such as school transport and regulatory agencies as part of their share of funding the SRS of public schools.
Well, thank you, Andy. If you've been listening to us over the previous weeks, you would know that there's a $2.4 billion cut to education here in Victoria from a Labor government. Labor governments in both the federal and the state area, which makes you wonder about the Labor governments, don't you? I don't think they should call themselves Labor. Anyway, public schools have got their fighters, not just the dogs, and the school staff have been rallying outside Minister Tierney's office down there, I think it's in Geelong, to protest the $2.4 billion public school funding cuts in this state. Over to Andy again.
Thanks, Jean. School staff rally outside Minister Tierney's office to protest $2.4 billion public school funding cuts. Public school teachers, education support staff and school leaders rallied outside the Geelong electorate office of State Labor Minister Gail Tierney on the 4th of August, demanding the reversal of the Allan Labor government's $2.4 billion cut to public schools. The Allan government, including the local MP, have decided to deny public schools billions of dollars by delaying their commitment to fully fund public schools to 2031. Victoria's public schools are experiencing a workforce shortage crisis at a time when the number of schools and students is growing, meaning more teachers and other school staff are needed. Australian Education Union Victorian Branch President Justin Mullaly has said that the Allan Labor government's cuts work against fixing the chronic workforce shortages. Right now, Victoria's public schools are the lowest funded in the country and our teachers are the lowest paid, with education support staff and school leaders undervalued. To deny public schools full and fair funding during a shortage of teachers shows that the Labor government's claims that Victoria is the education state is hollow. Gail Tierney, other local Labor MPs and the Premier need to explain why they do not value Geelong, Bellarine and Surf Coast public school students and their teachers, principals and education support staff. Schools in New South Wales and other states and territories are already funded to the level which is being denied to local public schools because of funding cuts by the Premier and her government. The Allan Labor government must deliver full funding in a fair and meaningful way. This will ensure Victorian public schools can attract and retain teachers and education support staff, reduce class sizes, and provide more of the individual support that every student needs. The Allan Labor government is showing contempt towards Victorian public school workers, parents, and students. That is disgraceful. The Premier and Gail Tierney must fix this mess, Mr. Mullaly said, and they definitely should. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy, but we'll have a bit of a break now.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we've got here a very interesting article from The Educator, which Dale is bringing to us. It's about AI. Over to you, Dale.
Thank you, Jean. I have an article here by Sara Abdul-Morgood titled, "Don't Blame AI for Schooling's Decline." It's just exposing cracks that were already obvious and growing. When schoolwork links directly to real-world issues, students are more likely to use AI not to replace learning, but to extend and deepen it. "I don't have to go to school anymore," said my Year 8 son during one of our regular conversations about why school matters. ChatGPT has a study and learn option now. Why sit in a classroom when AI can explain lessons and deliver answers instantly? The only reason he still attends school, he added, is to see his friends. It might sound like adolescent bravado, but my son's remark captures a broader truth. Young people are increasingly questioning the value of formal education. They compare the immediacy and variety of on-demand knowledge, including quick AI-generated answers, with the rigidity of school curricula. For many, these sources feel faster, clearer, and more relevant than the slow pace and fixed structure of the classroom. Many critics interpret this attitude as evidence of a broader educational crisis, with AI at least partly to blame for student disengagement. For example, when the New South Wales Education Department banned ChatGPT and similar tools in public schools early in 2023, it warned that AI could allow fluent but lazy thinking to go unchallenged and devalue authentic student learning. Reinforcing this concern, the Paul Ramsey Foundation-sponsored report Shaped AI and EdTech to Tackle Australia's Learning Divide argues that introducing AI tools without the right frameworks risks alienating students. If new digital tools widen the gap between how students learn and how schools teach, those students may feel increasingly disconnected from and question the relevance of school itself. The report's author, Leslie Lobel, stresses that without strong governance and thoughtful design, the tools will push students further away from learning rather than bringing them closer. It's important to remember, though, that students were questioning the relevance of their schooling long before AI came onto the scene. Research across Australia consistently shows that student engagement and sense of belonging have been at a steady decline. Between 2003 and 2015, data from the OECD's Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, revealed that the share of Australian 15-year-olds who agreed that they feel like they belonged at school fell from 88 to 72%, almost double the average decline across OECD countries. Over the same period, the proportion who reported feeling disconnected from school also rose sharply, particularly in the middle years of high school, around year 9 when disengagement peaks. Those least likely to feel a sense of belonging included Indigenous students, girls, students from less well-off backgrounds, Australian-born students, and those in provincial and remote areas. International data backs this up. The PISA studies have identified key predictors of student disengagement, including a low perceived value of school, poor classroom climate, and weak teacher-student relationships. When school feels unsafe or irrelevant, or when students don't have positive relationships with teachers, they inevitably tune out. Lessons are too often framed as preparation for the next exam, rather than opportunities to explore and apply knowledge in authentic ways. Many students also feel they have little voice in what or how they learn. Their role is to receive and reproduce information, not to shape the learning process. It's no wonder so many struggle to see a meaningful connection between what they do in class and the realities of their future lives. We can't simply blame individual teachers for these outcomes. Staff in Australian schools report some of the highest workloads in the OECD. Many work well beyond their contracted hours just to keep up with administration demands, constant curriculum changes, and pastoral care responsibilities. disabilities. A 2022 Grattan Institute survey found that teachers work about 55 hours a week on average, far above the standard working week, yet less than half of that time is spent teaching or interacting with students. The rest is devoured by paperwork, meetings, data entry, and other tasks. Disengagement is the product of a system that prioritizes compliance, standardization, and measurable targets over curiosity, relationships, and real-world relevance. In this light, my son's comment starts to make sense. When students feel disconnected from what's happening in the classroom and see little link between schoolwork and their own goals, it's hardly surprising they turn to AI. By the time they finish school, many have learned to see education as something to endure rather than a space to explore and grow. My son was voicing what many students feel, that the education system is struggling to keep pace with the way they learn and live. The first step to reducing students' over-reliance on AI is to make learning more relevant and engaging. Too often, lessons are framed as preparation for the next test or assignment rather than opportunities to grapple with real-world challenges. When students are asked to solve problems that connect with their lives, from environmental issues to ethical dilemmas to practical applications of maths and science, their learning feels purposeful. This could mean project-based work, with students collaborating to design ways of reducing waste in their school, designing a more inclusive public space, or creating campaigns around health and well-being. In classrooms, it could mean shifting discussions beyond textbook answers into debates that evaluate competing perspectives, with students weighing evidence, challenging assumptions, and justifying their reasoning. Students should be given more opportunities for inquiry and more choice in how they demonstrate their learning, whether that's through a presentation, a group project, or a community partnership. Lessons would become spaces of exploration, helping students see that what they are learning has a direct bearing on the futures they are preparing for. Australian research supports this approach. A uni essay study earlier this year asked disengaged senior students to design and build a playground for a low-income school, combining inquiry, service, and skills-based learning with teachers acting as facilitators. Students set achievable goals, conducted market research to identify community needs, and explored multiple design options before selecting the most viable. The researchers found that disengaged students are more likely to participate when learning connects to the real world, benefits their communities, and gives them opportunities to make authentic decisions. A South Australian trial of project-based mathematics reached a similar conclusion. It found that students in project-based classes reported greater enjoyment, stronger academic confidence, and higher achievement than those in traditional classrooms. The approach was open-ended and inquiry-driven, with teachers facilitating group projects rather than delivering content. Unlike textbook-driven lessons, the project began with a problem and introduced the maths needed to solve it. If students see how their studies link directly to real-world issues and their futures, they are less likely to view AI as a shortcut and more likely to use it constructively, not to replace their learning, but to extend and deepen it. The pressure is not only on students. Increasingly, educators themselves turn to AI to prepare course content, streamline administration, or even generate assessment tasks. While this reliance is understandable in a system where staff are expected to do more with less, it risks hollowing out the very heart of education, the transfer of expertise, judgment, and experience from educator to learner. Students notice this too, and they rightly ask, if their lecturers are leaning on AI, why shouldn't they? When both sides are outsourcing parts of the learning process, the human connection at the core of education is put at risk. Until we make those changes, AI will remain less an opportunistic shortcut than a necessary crutch. We need to be talking not about how AI is ruining education, but about why our educational infrastructure is so brittle that a chatbot could exploit its weaknesses overnight. Only by tackling those underlying fault lines, the relevance of our curriculum, the way we measure success, the support we give both learners and teachers, can we ensure that the next technological disruption becomes a tool for empowerment rather than an escape hatch from a broken status quo. AI didn't create the cracks in our education system. It's just accelerating and illuminating them. The responsibility is now on educators, policymakers, parents, and communities to build an education system that reflects our highest aspirations for learning, one where technology complements genuine engagement rather than substituting for it. Only then will students choose substance over shortcuts, because the learning experience will finally be worth their while. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Dale. It's very interesting. We're on to another subject now. The Dogs are very much believers in the separation of religion from the state. And as in America, some people in Australia think that we should be teaching particular religions in our government schools. But our government schools are for everybody. Let's find out about how people think when they're asked about teaching religion in our public schools.
Thanks, Jean. Australians evenly split on teaching religion in government schools. New Roy Morgan research reveals a profound shift in Australian attitudes towards religious education in government schools, with support sitting evenly at 50% in favour and 50% opposed teaching religion at least once a week. This represents a complete reversal of sentiment over a generation. In 1997-98, support for weekly religious instruction was overwhelming, with 72% of Australians in favour and just 28% opposed. Over the following two decades, support gradually eroded, slipping below 70% in the early 2000s and into the low 60s by the mid-2010s. For the first time, support and opposition reached parity 2021-2022, marking a critical convergence. The trajectory then continued, with the no vote overtaking the yes vote for the first time in 2022-23, establishing a narrow majority of 51% to 49%. This shift from majority to minority support signalled the end of long-standing consensus. Support and opposition then held steady in 2023-24 at 51% to 49%. In the year to June 2025, Australians are perfectly divided, with 50% opposing weekly religious teaching in government schools and 50% in favour. The data highlight a significant cultural shift in Australia, reflecting growing secularisation, greater diversity of beliefs, and evolving expectations about the role of religion in public education. Roy Morgan interviewed a representative cross-section of 1,427,846 Australians aged 14 plus from July 1997 to June 2025 who were asked, "Do you think religion should or should not be taught at least once a week in government schools?" The majority of Australian voters now oppose teaching religion in government schools. A majority of 51% of Australian electors now oppose the idea that religion should be taught at least once a week. In the late 1990s, Labor voters were strongly in favour, with 72% supporting religious education and only 28% opposed. Over the past two decades, however, support has collapsed. By 2024-25, fewer than half of ALP voters, 44%, wanted religion taught weekly, while a majority, 56%, were opposed. This represents a complete reversal of opinion among Labor supporters. Coalition voters remain the strongest backers of religious education. Support has declined 18 percentage points from 79% in 1997-98 to 61% in 2024-25, but a clear majority still favour weekly religious instruction. Greens voters have seen the steepest collapse in support, down 30 percentage points. In 1997-98, a majority of 61% supported religious education and 39% opposed. by 2024-25, only 31% supported, while 69% opposed, making Greens voters the most strongly against religion in schools. The tipping point occurred around 2008-09, when opposition overtook support. One Nation voters have historically leaned heavily in favour. Support was 75% in the late 1990s, before slipping to 57% this year. Independents and other minor parties voters once more are in line with the national average, with 70% support in 1997-98, and support has since fallen to just 48% in 2024-25, while opposition has risen to 52%, reflecting a majority now against. These political differences underline how attitudes towards religion in education have fractured over time. What was once a broadly bipartisan consensus has evolved into a deeply partisan issue, with progressive voters strongly opposed, conservative voters largely supportive, and the balance of opinion among independents tipping against. And back to you, Jean.
Well, wasn't it interesting? But let's have a bit of a break now, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on digital and online. 3CR Radical Radio.
3CR. Well, we hope that you're still listening to the Dogs program, because we're going overseas now with our international expert, Jeff, is going to take us to the Ukraine, the UK and the US. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. We're going to start this week in the United States, but this one's from the Network for Public Education. It's an article by Jan Ressinger. The Trump admin says public schools can stop protecting students' right to learn the English language. And she begins, "One recent move by the Trump administration was to remove yet another educational safeguard for students whose first language is not English." Jan Ressinger explains what happened and what it means. The Trump administration has rescinded an important federal education guidance document released in 2015 by the Obama administration to protect the right to English language instruction for all public school students whose primary language is not English. The New York Times' Dana Goldstein explains, "The Trump administration has rescinded federal guidance requiring schools to provide a broad range of services to students who are not proficient in English. Those services include language acquisition classes, supports for disabilities, and access to grade-level curriculum materials. The guidance was issued in 2015 under President Barack Obama. At that time, the Education and Justice Departments told school districts that failing to provide such services would violate Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which seeks to prevent discrimination based on race and national origin. But under President Trump, the White House has pursued a near reversal of the federal government's interpretation of Title VI. Instead of using the law to seek support for racial and ethnic minorities, as it was established to do, the administration has often argued that efforts to help groups such as immigrant and black children are discriminatory towards other students. For the Washington Post, Laura Meckler and Justine McDaniel provide context for the Trump administration's move on August 19 to reduce federal protection for the rights of the public school students learning English. Many of them born in the United States. It's also among the first steps in a broader push by the Trump administration to remove multilingual services from federal agencies across the board, an effort the Justice Department has ramped up in recent weeks. The moves are an acceleration of President Donald Trump's March for First Order, declaring English the country's official language, and they come as the administration is broadly targeting immigrants through its deportation campaign and other policy changes. The Justice Department sent a memorandum to all federal agencies last month, directing them to follow Trump's executive order, including by rescinding guidance related to the rules about English language learners. Meckler and McDaniel describe how, in a July memorandum, Attorney General Pam Bondi justifies the Trump administration's cancellation of protection of students' right to instruction in the English language. Attorney General Pam Bondi cited case law that says treating people, including students who aren't proficient in English, differently does not on its face amount to discrimination based on national origin. Other guidance related to language access for people using services across the federal government is also being suspended, according to the memo, and the Justice Department will create new guidance by mid-January to help agencies prioritise English while explaining precisely when and how multilingual assistance remains necessary. The aim of the effort, Bondi said in a statement published alongside the memo, is to promote assimilation over division. Goldstein reports that the Trump administration is not forcing school districts to stop teaching English to students who need English language instruction. School districts might not immediately changed their practices in response to the rescission. Many are committed to providing these services, but experts cautioned that without the federal pressure, some districts would weaken their supports for students learning English. Staff cuts at the Education Department have drastically reduced the number of employees who support local schools in the area of language acquisition, and civil rights. The Obama administration's 2015 guidance traces the legal history of the Protection of the Public School Students' Right to Learn English, Meckler and McDaniel explain. The requirement to serve English language learners in school is based on two federal statutes. The first is Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which bars discrimination based on national origin, among other traits. A landmark 1974 Supreme Court case, Lau versus Nichols, interpreted this law to include a mandate for English language services in schools. The second federal law at issue is the 1974 Equal Education Opportunities Act, which requires public schools to provide for students who do not speak English. A 1981 case was decided in federal appeals court, Castaneda versus Picard, laid out a test which to determine whether schools were properly providing services to English learners in schools. In 2015, the Justice and Education Departments published their 40-page guidance document explaining how schools can properly comply with these laws and avoid potential federal investigations and penalties. Chalkbeat's Kaylin Belcher explains further why the guidance for the education of English language learners seems so complicated. Unlike students with disabilities, whose rights are clearly spelled out in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the rights of English learners stem from multiple Supreme Court cases and federal laws that prohibit discrimination based on national origin, which courts have interpreted to mean that schools must take steps to help children overcome language barriers so they can obtain a meaningful education. The 2015 guidance, just rescinded, was groundbreaking when it was released under the former President Barack Obama and remained a critical resource, according to educators who relied on the guidance. It gathered various case law, legal precedents and federal requirements regarding English learners in the same place and provided clear examples about how students should be served. Meckler and McDaniel quote a former official from the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights describing the injustice likely to ensue now that the 2015 guidance protecting the right to instruction in the English language has been cancelled. The Department of Education and the Department of Justice are walking away from 55 years of legal understanding and enforcement. I don't think we can underestimate how important that is, said Michael Pereira, an attorney who worked on the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights for 10 years and now directs the Educational Opportunities Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Without pressure from the federal government to comply with the law, it's possible that some school districts will drop services, Pereira said, particularly as many districts struggle with financial pressures. It's going to ripple quickly. Schools were doing this because the Office for Civil Rights told them they had to. Goldstein quotes an extremely troubling statement from an official at the Trump administration's Department of Education who explains that the 2015 guidance document was overly prescriptive and micromanaging of how states implement federal English language programs. States have vastly different needs for this important population of students and are best equipped to determine how best to educate these students while following all applicable federal laws. I wonder how this official defines the purpose of education. While most of us define public education as a right, whose purpose is to help each child fulfil his or her promise, this official appears to consider it each state's right to prepare children for a particular role in the social and economic structure. Is the official from the Trump's Department of Education imagining the kind of manual labour training that was often provided for former slaves after the Civil War, or the domestic and manual labour training that was the purpose of the outing program in many American Indian boarding schools? Is this Education Department official imagining that learning English is unnecessary for some children who will never be part of mainstream American life? That's the end of the article. The Trump administration there is furthering the divide between students who've come from a different ethnic background and the mainstream. Now, I'll just go to a small, just a notice of an article that appeared on the Relief Web. It's an international report compiled by the UNESCO. The article is called Mental Health and Psychosocial Support in Ukrainian Education, a Comprehensive Study of the Service System. This is just the executive summary, and I encourage you to jump on the web and read the report if you are interested. But essentially, this report represents findings from a comprehensive nationwide study commissioned by UNESCO Antenna in Ukraine, evaluating the current state of mental health and psychosocial support in Ukraine's educational system amid the war. The research is focused on addressing the effectiveness of current approaches, analysing changes, studying the experience of implementing these services in schools, as well as identifying existing needs and developing recommendations for system transformation. And I won't read the whole methodology, but essentially they surveyed 1,500 parents of school-aged children, 903 education professionals, 495 school psychologists, that's something, 284 teachers, many people. It's a very broad-ranging report, and it is marked, as you might expect, the psycho-emotional impact of war on children has led to a marked deterioration in children's emotional well-being. All groups of respondents surveyed agreed that with the beginning of the full-scale war, the demand for psychological help from students has increased significantly. This is reported by 79% of teachers, 84.5% of psychologists, and 82% of surveyed school administration representatives. 51% of psychologists believe that most of all students in their schools require psychological help, compared to 23% of teachers. 22% of parents state their child requires professional psychological support. They say when assessing their child's emotional state, 26% of parents report that children have emotional instability. 7% of parents state their children have constant anxiety. At the same time, 67% of parents assess their children's emotional state as rather or very calm, which in the context of overall study data may include limited awareness of parents regarding the criteria for anxiety. Psychologists also reporting increasing cases of grief, post-traumatic stress, behavioural disorders, social isolation, sleep issues and loss of academic motivation. I'm just flagging that this report is out there. If any of you are researchers and wanted to understand or some of the complications that people are coping with in Ukraine, it's having an impact on the psychological health of kids, as you'd expect. A lot of schools there are now underground. With that, I'm just mentioning that because children still need to be educated and public education is under threat directly in the case of Ukraine, and our hearts go out to them. We're going to go to a happier story now. We're going to go to England, and this is a report came from the Education Hub. Phase 2 of the school-based nursery program, everything you need to know. Parents need quality, affordable childcare in their local area so that every child can have the best start in life. Already, Phase 1 of the school-based nursery capital grant is making a difference to thousands of families across the country, supporting the childcare expansion. 300 schools received funding this year to create up to 6,000 new nursery places. As part of our plan to create thousands of new places in school-based nurseries, we have now entered the second phase of the program, focusing on supporting families in disadvantaged areas to better access early years provision. Between the 22nd of September and the 11th of December, primary schools can apply for up to £150,000 of funding to create or expand on-site nurseries. Think kindergartens. Maintained nursery schools are now also eligible to apply. But what are school-based nurseries and who will benefit? Here's everything you need to know. What is a school-based nursery? A school-based nursery is a nursery provision located on a school site. The nursery setting may operate independently from the school or could be run by the school. Some will offer childcare for ages 3 and 4, where others will cater for younger children. This will depend on the individual setting, as there are different regulations for schools to follow depending on the age group. Why are nurseries in schools popular with parents? Quality school-based nursery provision is popular with parents, especially families with children of different ages. It can mean a single point of contact, either drop-offs and pick-ups, of continuity of care from the beginning of a child's education. What are the other benefits of a school-based nursery? The entire diverse childcare sector provides valuable care with schools at the heart of our communities. School-based nursery settings see lower staff turnover, serve a greater proportion of children with special education needs and disabilities, and are more prevalent in deprived areas. Teachers have told us the benefits of nurseries on site, saying it helps them to build strong relationships between nursery and school staff, which can lead to smoother transitions into school for children. How many new school-based nurseries are being created? From the first round of funding, 300 new school-based nurseries are due to create places, with the majority in the 25-26 academic year. Schools are on track to deliver over 4,000 new early years places this September. Backed by £45 million of funding, Phase 2 will deliver at least 300 new or expanded school-based nurseries ready to offer new childcare places in the 26-27 academic year. Where will these be located? The majority of Phase 1 school-based nurseries are in the north or Midlands, including around 1 in 10 in the northeast, increasing access to childcare in areas where it's most needed. For phase two, our goal is to build capacity in areas of need. We aim to build new school-based nurseries all over the country, especially in places that are disadvantaged. How is this being funded? The government has pledged almost £370 million to further fund the program. But essentially what it is an expansion of public money going towards helping people to improve their commitment to public education and to assist people in their everyday lives. Something this is shown to be popular all over the world where it's been installed, especially in the Scandinavian countries. The provision of broad-based childcare, making it better for kids and parents who can get to better outcomes all around. Anyway, that's a positive story. I think we should look at, the Australian government should look at that sort of thing here and create more childcare places. Anyway, with that, we'll leave you all, and I hope you have a very pleasant weekend. Cheerio.
Well, thank you so much, Jeff. It's great to know what's going on overseas, isn't it? But we come to the best part of our program now, the good news story. And there's some good news from Tasmania, where there's some young gardeners at work in the north of Hobart. So over to Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Growing Change, a different kind of school garden program, is improving student outcomes in Tasmania. The 24 Carats Kitchen Garden program, founded by Tasmanian artist Kersha Kachel, aims to integrate art and lifestyle into every aspect of the project. And this was published on the 8th of September, written by Helen Cushing. Undaunted by the chilly midwinter's morning, groups of Year 6 students at Tasmania's Moonar Primary School are digging out last season's sweet corn plants, sieving compost, planting seedlings, and harvesting vegetables for a shared lunch. Meanwhile, in the warmth of the kitchen, aprons on, young minds are focused on preparing broccoli balls with zesty lemon dip, pea and leek tart, and vegetarian dumplings. Guided by their kitchen and garden specialists, the students are engaged and confident, quietly chatting as they work on allotted tasks. The groups are among the 2,000 students in 24 primary and high schools across Tasmania who are part of 24 Carat Gardens, a kitchen garden program for low socioeconomic schools founded in 2014 by Mona artist and philanthropist Kersha Kachel. Participating schools are supported to establish food gardens and kitchens and to attend workshops at Material Institute, the organisation's hub in Hobart's outer suburb of Bridgewater, which includes a market garden, nursery, art studio, cafe with training kitchen, and a beauty lab. The Garden to Plate principle is enriched by a belief in the importance of design, aesthetics, and beauty. Workshop days include an art activity related to the kitchen garden theme, such as making a clay cup or indigo dyeing fabric for napkins. What differentiates us from other programs is the integration of art and lifestyle into every aspect of the project. We believe this artfulness is transformative, says Kachel. The children agree. I've made friends in the garden, says John Smith from Year 8 at Montrose Bay High School. One of my bullies actually became my friend because of this garden, which I find pretty cool. At an interdisciplinary workshop for Year 4 students from Brighton Primary School, ceramic artist George Vozar supervises 12 children as they concentrate on shaping clay slips into mugs. Noticing one girl's creativity, Vozar says, "Whoa, look at this unicorn." Mugs made, the kids rotate to their next activity, preparing soup from freshly harvested vegetables with head chef Vladimir Panovin. The program has been found to have a positive effect on literacy and numeracy, increased development of practical skills, and opportunities for one-on-one learning for at-risk students. Professionals like Vozar and Panovin are key to the success of 24 Carat Gardens. Consultation with professionals is a defining feature of the program, from the design and development of the gardens to an ongoing presence in the schools, says Operations Manager Ruben Parker-Greer. Each school has a kitchen and garden specialist on staff who run the programs. My personal little mission is safe, engaging and productive. In that order, says Chris Atkinson, Derwent Park Primary's garden specialist. The goal is that the children are involved and busy, wanting and experimenting something new, becoming confident at putting bricks in a wheelbarrow and pushing it around, raking leaves and making compost. Doing something physical can help kids who have trouble engaging in the classroom. It's an approach that can lead to higher attendance and an increased sense of belonging and engagement from students, according to a 2025 evaluation report by the University of Tasmania. That report was on a four-year study of an expanded program offered to all students from K to 6 at Clarendon Vale Primary School, where 80 out of 132 children are on alternative learning plans. The expanded program is integrated into the entire curriculum. It's exciting to see kitchen and garden skills being embedded in literacy and numeracy, says Parker Greer. As well as improved attendance and engagement, the report found the program had a positive effect on literacy and numeracy, increased development of practical skills, and opportunities for one-on-one learning for students who are at risk or who have different learning styles. It also found the kitchen and garden staff provided familiarity and continuity, reducing the impact of broader teacher turnover on student wellbeing. The program, which receives some state government funding as well as philanthropic and grant money, is now expanding throughout Tasmania. Really rich applied learning creates self-confidence, enabling engagement and connection, says Dr. Abby McDonald, who led the research. That's the glue bringing people together to share experiences and knowledge. Clarendon Vale Primary School Project Officer Serena King says it is essential to provide an alternative learning environment for children who disengage with books in a classroom setting. At our school, we are planting more than just seeds. We are planting a sense of belonging and opportunity, she says. Students bring lessons learned in the kitchen garden home to their families. I was so excited to be breakfast club leader, says Year 6 student Madeline Suckling. We get to try heaps of new foods. We made a noodle omelette. It was so good. I went home and made it for mum. It was amazing. The program, which receives some state government funding as well as philanthropic and grant money, is now expanding throughout Tasmania. Food is a binding force for humanity, says Parker Greer. It's like an ecological umbilical cord. Supporting food literacy from the base of flourishing gardens welcomes the community into a safe space where students connect with nature and each other. Back to you, Jane.
So you won't be surprised that our great state school of the week is Moona Primary School, and here's a few facts and figures about it.
Thanks, Jane. And this week's great state school of the week is Moona Primary School, Derwent Park, Tasmania. The core values of staff at Moona Primary School are honesty, respect, professionalism, innovation, positivity, caring, commitment, and resilience. Students value being safe, respectful, and fair. The school achieves its mission by nurturing each individual learner and cultivating a strong sense of community. Moona Primary has a current population of over 220 students, kinder to grade 6. Our school is a vibrant, exciting learning opportunity which provides many opportunities for students. Moona Primary School is the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Demonstration School for Tasmania. All grade 3 to 6 students participate in a 45-minute weekly gardening session and a 1.5-hour weekly cooking session. Each of these are facilitated by specialist staff, a gardening specialist and a cooking specialist. Moona Primary provides training and support for other schools in Tasmania who are involved in the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden program. Students sit together and eat their meal at the end of the cooking session, developing social skills. The Kitchen Garden program is heavily supported through parent and community volunteers. Teachers utilise this program to teach many curriculum areas in an integrated way, including science, maths, literacy, sustainability and social skills. Moona Primary also provides an early learning program which caters for children from birth to 5 years. Each week, we provide 3 to 4 sessions facilitated by our teacher coordinator. These sessions are fun and educational and provide great opportunities for socialising for the children and their parents. We have fortnightly out and about excursions where families can experience a range of places to visit with a bus provided free of charge. A parent room provides tea and coffee facilities, toys and comfortable couches to welcome parents into the school at any time during school hours. At Moona, we strongly believe education is a process shared between school and home. Students are placed in composite classes based on their personal, social, intellectual and physical needs. we offer specialist music, Japanese, science and physical education programs. This year, students have also had access to drama and visual art experiences with a specialist teacher. Students in grade 5 to 6 have the opportunity to participate in the band program. Our school participates in the National Wakakiri Story Dance Festival every year, including all interested students from prep to grade 6. Meenah Primary have developed a whole school approach to teaching literacy and numeracy over the past 5 years. All students engage in writer's workshop and guided reading each week. Staff plan using First Steps and have engaged in professional learning around reading comprehension and teaching grammar. Grade 5 and 6 students have been involved in the Quick Smart program this year for the first time to enhance their mental computational skills. Moonah Primary values its many links with the local community. And now some facts and figures from the MySchool website. Current enrolment 208, and the ICSEA value well below average at 945. Representative of a diverse urban community. 8% of students have parents in the upper 25% of incomes. 15% of students in the second quartile of parental income. The third quartile of incomes accounts for 26% of students, and the lowest quartile of parental incomes accounts for 51% of students, with 25% speaking a language other than English at home and 14% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $991,000 and $3.5 million from the Victorian Government. Private fees and contributions add another $21,000, and other private contributions $25,000. And that works out per pupil at $22,952. The capital, $281,980 over 3 years. The school is doing an amazing job on very meagre funding. And back to you, Jean.
Congratulations to Moonah Primary School. If you want to find out more about us, you've got our website at www.adogs.info. But from Dale, Andy, Jeff and myself, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find Joe Hill. It's there you'll find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.